Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today we're joined by Riku Merikoski from AXPO, and we're going to be talking about the Nordic power markets. So the first thing we covered was on storage in those markets. So is storage a good idea considering there was a lot of hydro within those regions? The second thing we covered was on the move from a national market in 2011 to a zonal market for Sweden. And how has that been perceived by consumers, but also are the price signals working? The third thing we covered was on interconnection. So is interconnection a good idea for a region, and is it lowering bills for consumers? And finally, how do you get bills down for consumers? Should you be subsidizing summer houses? Let's jump in. Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today we're joined by Riku. Riku, welcome.
Thank you.
And Riku, I'm actually going to come straight to you to ask you a couple of questions. So who are you and what is your role within energy markets in the Nordics?
Yes. So my name is Riku Merikoski. I'm working as a senior power analyst at AXPO. And my main responsibility is the fundamental analysis of Nordic and UK power markets in the headquarters of AXPO. Before AXPO, I have a long experience in the Nordic power market as I was the lead analyst at Finnish national utility Fortum. And before that, even I worked for various utility and market analysis companies in the Nordics.
Okay. And just as a fun question, whereabouts are you from, Riku?
I'm close from Tampere, Finland. So worked like in home country before joining AXPO in Switzerland.
Okay, superb. And just to give people a brief introduction to the Nordic markets, how would you describe the Nordics to people?
Well, the Nordic power market is one of the really first international power markets which existed in the world, because we are relatively small countries all, so we built them together already years ago. And they are also one of the cleanest power markets in all of the world, mainly because we traditionally have very good part of hydro in the electricity mix, more than half still today. Then also we have a quite significant portion of nuclear power in Finland and Sweden, and then lately wind power has been growing in its part quite a lot. So trees, like conventional thermal power, there is not much left of that in the Nordics anymore.
Okay, no, interesting. And in terms of running a system like that, so without much kind of thermal capacity left, how does the Nordic market deal with kind of that circumstance that we kind of come across in the UK, where you don't have very much wind or you don't have very much solar? Is that something that you're able to deal with because of the hydro capabilities that you have?
Yes, I would say so. That traditionally the Nordic system has not had much problems with, let's say, generation adequacy, because the hydro fleet is very flexible, especially in Norway and Sweden, which have large reservoirs up in the mountains, and those you can then produce at request and when you really need it. So it's mainly Finland and Denmark are the countries which have needed some thermal capacity, but now with the improved transmission capacity and also increased wind power, then we have, let's say, shut down quite a lot of that thermal fleet as well. And now lately, actually, also Finland has been sometimes quite tight, and likewise Denmark. And actually, even inside Sweden, there are regions which have problems sometimes.
Okay, and we'll come on to that in a second. So the region's comment kind of leads us towards where the next question's going. But just before we go off that topic, so hydro, we know there are various types of hydro that you can have on the system. What is the mix like between, say, run-of-river hydro, which is perhaps less controllable, and something like pumped hydro within the Nordics?
The Nordic mix is quite heavily, let's say, biased to the very flexible hydro side, because the Norwegian and also northern Swedish mountain areas are relatively high and also get quite a lot of precipitation. So there is naturally quite a lot of water coming in, and also then in the springtime the snow melt is quite significant. So actually we don't have, in relation to the total capacity, there is not that much pumped storage because there is just no need for it, because you just keep the water from the spring flow, and that's how you pump it, by just waiting for the snow melt. We have even some reservoirs which are, let's say, multi-annual reservoirs, so they can hold water more than a year worth of inflow, which then makes you quite flexible in the short term.
Okay, and perhaps comparing just the size of that hydro, last question on the hydro, so the size of that hydro to the size of the demand in the country, to give people a feel for kind of how big that fleet is?
In the Nordic market, that's more than half of all the power production comes from hydro, something 55-60%, depending a bit on the year and how high the demand is. So like very significant part.
Great. Okay. I think it's really useful context. And you mentioned this in one of your earlier questions. You mentioned pricing for regions. And this is because the Nordics operate a zonal system for their pricing. So how would you describe what zonal pricing is to listeners?
I would say that the origins of Nordic zonal pricing lies in the Norwegian experience mainly, where the, let's say, geography is quite challenging. Norway is a long but narrow country with quite challenging geography. So they practically realized quite early already that it's very challenging to build a good national grid. So they practically decided to that it's less costly to just accept that they have different grids in the different parts of the country. So then later they built them together so that they are connected, but they are still so weakly connected that one cannot call Norway copper plate. So and also because the hydropower dependency, it's very possible that it rains very differently in northern Norway than in southern Norway. So it might be that the hydro situation is very different in each part of the country, and then you can't run the market with the same market signals if others have reservoirs empty and others have it full.
Mm-hmm. And when you mention copper plate, what does that mean?
Yeah, the copper plate means that very often the market is based on either a national or zonal idea where you treat one area in the grid as if there was no transmission restrictions inside that area. And that's actually how the principle runs in quite many markets, that inside the country you don't make a locational difference in the power exchange.
Okay, and so that covers Norway. Does the same principle to zonal pricing apply across other regions?
Yes, in Denmark there are two areas, and that's also partially due to geography, because the one part of Denmark is connected by land to Germany, so it was always part of the Central European grid, and then actually the other part around the area of the capital, Copenhagen, that was already from quite far past, that was connected to the Swedish grid, so the actual Nordic grid, so they had this division by nature, I could say, or it was just easier to be that way. However, Sweden is there an exception, because their market was transitioned from a national to zonal market back in 2011. And that's actually one of the only markets where we have seen this division in Europe during the open market times.
Okay. So we will definitely come back to that, because I think for listeners within the UK, this is a very sort of hot topic, the difference between national markets and zonal markets. And so that'll be really interesting to kind of talk through and see what the pros and cons are of the approach. But this is first and foremost a podcast about battery storage. And so let's go to battery storage first. And so my real question is that with so much sort of hydro on the system, does it make sense to build battery storage in the Nordics?
I think for maybe 10 years ago, many people said that it would take a very, very long time until batteries could compete. However, I would say that in the latest years, also here, the attitude has changed. There is still challenges to batteries in that way that wherever you have the flexible hydro, it's quite competitive in providing, for example, let's say, much power at night or in the late evening or early morning. But and also it has been very good in delivering ancillary services. However, recently it has been found that actually batteries might be, especially in these fast ancillary services, those like which require very fast response, batteries can actually do it possibly even cheaper and also with less wear and tear. Because if you run very aggressively your hydro plant like up and down, it might over time, let's say, increase the maintenance costs. And batteries may be actually better in that respect. And their batteries have already taken some market share, also in the Nordics, which was for a long time thought to be very hard market to penetrate into.
Okay, so I think I would have guessed that the ancillary service portion batteries would be quite good at because of the speed of response. And so there's a natural kind of tendency for them to do that. But you're saying that actually beyond the ancillary services, the cost of storage is getting to a point where in some cases it can compete with pumped hydro, where it is essentially saving pumped hydro from sort of certain cycles of moving water. Is that right?
Yes, I would say so. And clearly, I think we are seeing already now that especially on the, now, like when we first started with that kind of development where the batteries were providing quite a lot of the capacity where you do second or like minute type of responses, I think we are, every year we are getting closer to that period where batteries also take some part from the, say, 15 minute variation, then maybe hourly variation and that kind of, I see the progress from the, let's say, fast products to even slower products.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, just if your batteries are competitive over a 10-minute period in the first year, if by the time they make it to the second year and their cost is, let's say, halved, then you'd expect the kind of duration for them to be competitive over would be longer.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Interesting. Okay. And now let's maybe try and tie in a little bit of this to the zonal discussion. So, if I'm a battery looking to connect in, say, Sweden or Norway, are there particular regions that are more appealing than others?
Definitely, because if you are in an area where there is a lot of this, like a huge overload of flexible hydro already, like this is the case, especially in northern Scandinavia, there normally the variation, for example, in intraday markets and balancing markets is much smaller than in the south. Because the south has quite a lot of consumption and in relation to that, not as much production. So what we are seeing is more investment in batteries in the consumption-rich areas, because those are the areas where you might have problems with, let's say, adequacy in cold winter moments or very calm sudden days or whatever you can think of. So in a way, it's clearly that the batteries are coming to where the hydro overload is not so big.
Okay, so the kind of the theory there is that you have lots of hydro in the north of Sweden, just to take Sweden as an example, and then you've got lots of demand around Stockholm, which is in the south of Sweden. And because there isn't enough transmission capacity between the two, then if you're a battery, it might make sense to be located down towards the demand. And so when the transmission line is congested and there are two different prices between the regions, it sort of makes sense from a business case perspective to be down closer to demand.
Yes, at least this far, that has been mostly the idea that in a way it would, let's say, alleviate the problems in those consumption-rich areas where the market situation and also actually the grid situation might sometimes be quite tight. Because Sweden is a country which is very reliant on getting quite a lot of power from the like transmitted from the north to the south. So if there is any, for example, maintenance work on those lines, then those intra-country price spreads might go quite significant.
Okay, and in terms of adding storage to a system like this, does it kind of help to better plan transmission capacities by knowing that you could add storage to particular zones, or like has that not sort of proven to be an outcome?
I do think that it helps because it at least gives you some idea. I mean, there is some very clear and very open locational signal where you could count a bit on that, which kind of revenues you could have access to. So, and in a way, what I have described so far is mostly the development we have seen thus far, but also in the future when we grow with wind power quite a lot in some areas, it might also start to make sense to build batteries close to wind plants to store power from those moments when you have an overload of wind, because that's also something which is becoming more common in the Nordics as well, that some areas of the grid have way too much wind power at times.
And this is almost starting to say that there are kind of different types of days. So you might get a day where you've got a huge wind overproduction and that creates £0 or negative pound prices. And that's a great thing for storage to support on and to make sure that excess is captured to whatever degree is commercially possible. And then you're also saying there are other types of days where there might be very high demand, but you just can't, you haven't got enough transmission capacity between the north and the south to meet that demand. And so therefore you might want to have storage assets in the south as well.
Exactly. So in a way, both kinds of events do happen, but let's say thus far, these high demand moments have been maybe more the driver for a battery investment side. Although in a way, I would say that the ancillary services have of course been the easy first step, but that's what you already know from Britain anyway.
We do. I was going to ask the question on the ancillary service side, is that all procured nationally or is that procured by zone?
That's procured nationally as far as I know, but different TSOs might have quotas on how much they need to procure on different areas. So I it's hard to say a bit like okay. On generally, but it's not optimal to have all those resources in one location. So they probably want to avoid that anyway.
Yes. Yeah. And we see the same thing in the UK, right? So when you're trying to provide like a stability service or a short circuit level, then there's a kind of a need to be in a particular part of the grid. So we definitely see some being procured nationally and some procured by region as well. So Sweden, and for the your sort of history lesson on this, it was it 2011?
Yes, 2011, the process of going Swedish price division, yes.
Okay, so we're now quite a long way down that process, more or less 15 years. Has it been considered a popular move?
I would say generally no, if one asks the people in southern Sweden. In the beginning, the change was actually relatively small, because at that time, the price differences were so small between areas that mostly people didn't take much notice. But especially there has been some new cables built from southern Norway and southern Sweden to central Europe. And then also we have shut down quite much of the thermal capacity, which also was located in the south. So practically the local power balance in southern parts of Sweden especially has become quite much weaker than it was for 10 or 20 years ago. And that has now caused quite often moments when southern Sweden can have quite tight power balance, high prices simultaneously as there is low prices in the north. And that has created quite a lot of criticism in Sweden and also in Norway.
Okay, that's really interesting. And the, perhaps part of the reason to have this prices by region is to give people an incentive to do something different. So you mentioned transmission capacity. So have people seen the kind of the price difference between, say, South Sweden and North Sweden and said, that highlights there is a lot of congestion there and that there's a good reason to build transmission capacity between these two regions?
Yes, that signal has worked very well, because very, very obviously now politicians and everyone else understands much better, due to this open price signal, that we need to build much more grids from the north to the south. And that is what is happening. Practically all the Nordic TSOs have quite extensive grid building, grid investment programs. And I'm not sure if we would have gotten here if the signal wasn't out there in the open.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to draw parallels with the UK, I think we definitely have the ambition to put these transmission lines in place, but we're perhaps behind where we should be And so we're seeing very large constraints in the GB market today. And perhaps just to ask another question about Sweden. So yeah, another part that gets talked about quite often in a move from, say, a national market to a zonal is this concept that demand might move. So you might have demand that wants to be in a different location. So have you seen demand looking to take advantage of those low power prices?
Let's start from the existing demand side. We really haven't seen much of the existing demand relocating. That's clearly not very easy to do. Your factory is where it is, and it's quite challenging to rebuild. I mean, the cost of moving a whole factory somewhere else is clearly not worth it. We haven't seen that happening. However, when we talk of the new consumption, we have had some industries and some investments clearly locating somewhere where the power price is lower. We have two very concrete examples of this. There is a big Facebook data center in very northern Sweden, which probably was clearly, let's say, attracted by the low power prices there. And then we also have this battery factory, Northvolt, which part of where the investment reasons and locations for their location was the low power price in the north.
And those are probably two really interesting examples, right? So on one hand, you have a data center which is not unmanned, but has not got a huge need for the number of qualified staff in comparison to its energy consumption. And you have a site like Northvolt, which requires many, many very skilled workers to be taking part in that manufacturing. And so do you see kind of a lesson in there around the types of demand that might respond to this pricing?
Well, at least in northern Sweden, there has been challenges on attracting enough people to work in a large factory there. And we see this pretty much in quite many other places as well, because it's not only thing that what the companies are looking for is low power prices, but it's also, let's say, it might be, for example, access to, if it's a data center, might be access to key data cables or access to capable staff and enough staff and all that. So in a way, clearly, power price is not the only thing what companies are looking for. So it's not as easy as one might imagine it on the drawing table.
Okay, so for some businesses where power price is a bigger chunk of the overall cost, very attractive, but for others where it's a smaller portion and there's, as you say, this kind of skilled workforce that needs to come alongside, then the kind of lure of those lower prices won't be so effective to bring industry up to those regions.
Yes, it remains to be seen how we are, for example, with hydrogen, that can we locate the hydrogen industry in those, let's say, power-rich areas with not so many people, or do we actually have to locate it close to the existing industries due to the, let's say, easier transmission of the hydrogen?
And perhaps it would just be helpful to put a number on this. So top of Sweden is SE1, is that right?
Yes, SE1 is north Sweden, and SE2 is also still very north of Sweden in the terms of power market. SE1 and SE2 are the north areas where it's low prices normally.
And then Stockholm is in SE4, is that right?
No, Stockholm is in SE3, so that's SE3. Still like middle Sweden, because then we have one further area in the south, SE4, which is where Malmö is located. But note also that Sweden is a very long country, about 2,000 kilometers from north to south.
I think where I'd like to go with this is just to give listeners a bit of context in terms of what the price difference looks like between, say, SE1 and SE4. How big is that difference? Are we talking a couple of pounds per megawatt hour, or is it bigger than that?
Well, now on annual level, if we look to the future, we would say that the difference is around, well, 20 euros per megawatt hour between the northern areas and the southern areas. But in the, let's say, extremes of single days and also during the energy crisis, it has been also much, much more. And those were the most critical moments, which were maybe, let's say, most criticized, because we have had days with more than 100 euro difference between the areas.
Okay. And really, my kind of final question around the zonal versus national. So if I was to say, Riku, you have the power to kind of choose which way you go. So to either kind of to have Sweden as a national power market, and or to have Sweden as a zonal market, given everything you know now, 15 years beyond that decision being made, which way would you have gone back in 2011, and why?
Well, in some ways, this is an impossible question, because Sweden didn't really have a choice here, because the European Commission said that the earlier behavior, where they practically moved the internal bottlenecks to the national borders, was pretty much illegal and against the EU rules. So it was more like forced upon Sweden, this price division. But when I look at it now, in the beginning, it felt for maybe many that it was maybe not so influential. But now when I see how clearly it has drawn light to this, let's say, big like lack of infrastructure, I think it has been a very good signal to show that in a way, now we know that this is crucially needed, this more transmission capacity. I think it has been very positive. And also, if we would have built all that wind power which we have done in northern Sweden and not have any locational signal like that, the situation would have been much, much worse still. Because then we would still play a game where we pretend as if there is no internal grid bottlenecks, while the grid bottlenecks have just become worse in the last 10 years. So I think it has been really useful. However, the main, let's say, main problem I see is that it has weakened the financial markets in Sweden. It's harder to hedge both in the short and long term, and that might make some investments harder. And I think that's also one thing to think about in GB, as the investments, like many might see the investments more risky after a zonal introduction. And this needs to be, let's say, covered somehow, especially if one wants to have a very, very high renewable target, as is in GB.
Yeah. And how does Sweden deal with that today? So let's say you're based in SE1, so at the north of the country. How do you hedge your output?
So in the Nordic market, there is this kind of Nordic system price, which is used as the financial market reference. So there is, let's say, it's totally artificial price, but that's used as a main financial reference for Nordic markets. And then on top of it, you buy, let's say, locational product, which is then in relation to that system price. So practically, you have two products to buy from the financial market instead of just one. So, but the problem is that the liquidity in the Nordic power market is not that good. So that has made it quite challenging to hedge, especially in the north, where there is not a lot of natural buyers of those products.
Great. So I think loads of lessons in there, and it's just super fascinating. The debate about national and zonal in GB has been running now for what seems like a very long time. But it is fascinating to get the take of someone who is active within a market that was national and is now zonal, alongside other zonal markets, which have always been zonal. And just to hear kind of what are the challenges, but also what are some of the benefits, and you know, kind of the things like the emergence of like strong price signals being a kind of really clear driver for investment being, it's just a fascinating insight for us in GB. So thank you for running us through that and those questions. So to move on from Sweden, because it feels like for an episode on the Nordics, we have spent a lot of time talking about Sweden. I'd like to go to some recent news that we've had around Norway. So there's been a lot of press recently on an announcement around interconnection renewal with Denmark, so between Norway and Denmark. What has been going on?
So there we have a situation where we have, during the last 10 years, we have added quite much transmission capacity from South Norway to Central Europe, and also one cable to Great Britain. And this has increased the price differences inside Norway. despite Norway is actually making quite much money with electricity exports, and also these cables have been fabulous investments, like really paying themselves off for a really reasonable time frame. But there's quite a lot of criticism in inside Norway, especially during the energy crisis, when southern Norwegian prices were often coupled with even Germany, which was then pretty high price. So then some Norwegian politicians are now using this as a reason to start actually reducing the transmission capacity to Central Europe in order to, let's say, hopefully lower prices for Norwegian consumers. I would say that this is a very short-sighted policy in that way, because Norway has been one of the worst countries in Europe in building new renewables in latest years. And its hydropower is actually benefiting quite a lot of this great opportunity to export at good prices. So, but this is so much from the consumer-centric perspective that as if the power market was only made to serve consumers, but well, no one would sell power to a market which is only for consumers.
Yeah, I suppose it is true, right, that power markets are for consumers at the end of the day. But are you making a kind of a broader point that you're saying so effectively, even though you can see the sort of the wholesale power prices are going up, there are revenues that are being generated by those interconnection cables that then feeds back into Norway? Is that how you'd see it?
That is true. But because as I said, the cables are creating quite a lot of income to the Norwegian TSO, Statnet. And that income, so-called bottleneck income, is used then, yes, it's also partially used for grid investments, which is supposed to be done, but also in addition to that, it's used to lower grid costs for the consumers. So if you would cut the capacity in those cables, then you would also lose some of that bottleneck income. So cutting those cables would actually increase then your grid costs, because you would have less income from that source. And why we are specifically talking about these Danish cables here is that there are some quite old cables between Norway and Denmark, which are up for a renewable in the next years. And now they need a reinvestment decision. And practically, normally you are not allowed to cut capacity, but you are, of course, allowed to. It's at least not illegal to not reinvest, which is the case now. So this is the discussion about this reinvestment of some of the cables between Norway and Denmark, which is political in Norway.
And maybe just to wrap up on this, so how do you think that will, because it feels like the EU and Norway are on a kind of a march to much more interconnection across all regions. It feels like the projections for interconnection in nearly every single market are maybe not doubling, but certainly going up by something like 50% over the next 5 to 10 years. How do you see this ending? Do you see those cables perhaps not getting that reinvestment? Or do you think that this kind of perhaps sense will kind of prevail and it will be built? Or at least, sorry, renewed?
I would believe that eventually there will be, the capacity will be, they will try quite a lot of things to keep the capacity at least to a present level. Maybe if you just stop the reinvestment, you might just somehow keep on running the existing stuff for a bit longer, and then you buy yourself time to reinvest in something. But I do think that this is maybe some kind of a turning point maybe in this whole discussion of transmission infrastructure, because I see in many countries that the attitudes are getting less positive to this international transmission, although it has been a great success for Europe in general. But people are not maybe realizing the benefits we are already now getting from it. And that's something which is quite hard to communicate, because people don't, it's not so easy to calculate what happens with a new interconnector.
Yeah, it feels like someone needs to kind of draw up a piece of paper that says, by the way, you paid £10 more for this interconnection through wholesale power prices, but you received £15 back through lower grid costs, and therefore you're £5 richer. And me being based in the UK, I've just used pounds, and I should definitely have not used pounds. But you understand the point.
Yeah, yes, I understand the point. But the problem is, of course, that it's not that simple in a way. Very likely not every consumer wins. Like, every single consumer cannot win when you make investments. But the idea should be that on average, people are better. And also on average, we get closer to the energy transition goals. Because what we should really remember here is that the Nordic very flexible hydropower is a great tool in also reducing the emissions in Central Europe if we just can transmit it. And also, if we look a bit forward, in, let's say, 5 years, I'm quite certain that, for example, Britain will have so much wind power that there's quite a lot of need for you to get rid of all of it. And then we will actually get, also the Nordics will get something back. So it's also partially this that some people in the Nordics are not seeing a bit into the future. Why? Because the very recent past has been so strong on export from the Nordics. But in the not so distant future, I think we will also get some quite relatively often imports from both Central Europe and also GB.
I have to agree. So, I mean, just to kind of say from the GB side, like, it's very possible that we might have a power price of, say, £1 or sort of £2. GB consumers will pay a subsidy to top up that wind generation. So it receives a price that is suitable for its investment. But then we could export that at £1 or £2 to Norway. And that is absolutely a very low cost generator for Norway to be able to import, which piggybacks on some of the investment and subsidy cost that's borne by UK consumers. So
exactly,
it's a real challenge for our system to how we think about that. But yeah, as you say, for Norway, it's a great opportunity.
Yes, and the same will definitely happen with solar power as well, because Central Europe is building very aggressively solar power, and we will have more and more moments when practically subsidized solar power from the south flows north, and we don't have to subsidize our own solar. That, like, we don't have to build so much subsidized stuff in the Nordics if we get part of it paid by someone else.
Understood. Okay, I'm going to come on to one more topic before going on to the final two questions. And this one, I can't even believe I'm having to read it out. So what is low-cost bills to summer houses? What does all of that mean?
So in Norwegian, there was a government crisis in Norway recently. And then, let's say, then the new minority one-party government came out with a promise of saying that we will provide cheap fixed price power for all households and also all summer houses of people, which is this is one of the largest state interventions in the energy market we have seen in the Western world for quite some time, I would say.
And just for people listening, like, it may seem second nature to you, but what is a summer house?
In the Nordics, where there is not so many people and quite a lot of empty space, so it's quite common for people to have second homes or something like that either on the mountains or by lakes, somewhere in the nature normally, where you can go, especially in the summer, and spend your time in the countryside in all peace.
Okay. And the policy is that those houses would get, like, lower cost energy. Is there more to it than that?
Yes. So that's the policy that the Norwegian government is planning to subsidize the consumption of households and these summer houses, so that they can heat up them nicely. It feels a bit strange policy, but that's how it is.
Does it create a problem? Does it create a problem in terms of, like, lots of houses, like, running their heating for much longer than they should?
Yes, very likely, because this proposed price is politically set, so it can practically then be eventually whatever, how low, like. And also, Norwegian government doesn't have much of problem of spending money because it has loads of it. So they can practically push the price as low as they want. But the problem is, of course, that if you give something at a heavily subsidized price, then eventually people start consuming quite much more. For example, they don't turn heating off because they state pays for it anyway. However, there will now they actually just recently published some details on this, and they will probably limit the volumes on this, that you can't use more than X amount of power per month, which of course is a sensible addition, because otherwise you would practically heat palaces with electricity.
Exactly. Okay. And there's actually a really good point within this, which is that in as part of the energy transition, people will want to feel like their bills are lower. And it's really critical if you've got large wind farms or lots of solar or lots of interconnection that people feel like their bills are lower. And I think there are lots of policy intervention choices that you can make. But I think lower cost bills for second homes feels a little bit like it might create unintended consequences. So yeah, fascinating to hear.
Yes, and definitely for, let's say, 95% of the world population, let's say, giving a subsidy for heating your second home feels a bit extraordinary, I would say.
Yes, yeah, I think so too. Okay, right, so we're just going to move on to the final two questions. So the first one is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Yes, I'm actually coming from Finland. I could plug one interesting thing which I see in Finland. We have quite, as we haven't also spoken that much about Finland yet. So Finland is a country with quite a lot of district heating networks. And we have a problem now recently when we have reduced quite a lot of the gas and coal use, which we used to have in district heating networks. But now we are using high amounts of biomass. And we actually, that's a bit when one looks at the biodiversity side, that's becoming a problem. We are cutting the forests down too much. And there is a Finnish nuclear power startup called Steady Energy, which plans to build heat-only nuclear reactors. And they have recently come up with quite significant investments from outside as well. I would say that I'm not certain that this will work eventually. However, I think it's a great idea because nuclear power industry has had quite a lot of problems with these very complex designs, very large projects, while now someone is trying to build something on nuclear which would have very simple design and very, let's say, easy setup with probably much lower construction time risks and all that. So I wish them all the best, I would say.
Yes, and good to get Finland in. I think we have skipped over Finland too much, and certainly that question on nuclear is like one of the really big ones, which is the SMRs, so the small modular reactors. How much kind of cost can they keep out of the nuclear process whilst keeping the safety standards high? And that really does define quite a lot of what the future system looks like, because if someone does come along there and deliver something that really works, it does change things quite a lot, particularly during winter period for Europe.
Especially, and in a way here, I think we are very easily say that, yeah, in somewhere in the very south, it's very easy to do everything with solar and batteries. But in the Nordics, we will have a very long winter for quite some time. And then it doesn't feel very comfortable to rely very strongly on solar in the winter time.
Yeah. I imagine you must get some really interesting dynamics in sort of when you get to close to 24 hours of sunlight, though, because your solar profile will be crazy. You will have a full day of solar generation.
Yeah. Although the let's say nighttime solar production is quite weak, because normally the angle is very non-advert, like not good for you, I would say. Unless you have some very special tracker which also follows the angle. But as far as I see, I don't think midnight sun will be a major producer anytime soon.
Okay. If someone wants to send in a generation profile of solar in the Nordics showing that 24/7 solar production is possible from the midnight sun, then please do. I would love to see it.
Yeah, it would be interesting, true.
It definitely would. Okay, so coming on to the final question. So, Riku, is there a contrarian view that you hold which the majority of the market doesn't agree with?
Yeah, I have been thinking of such a question that I think Europe has now lost two large fossil fuel providers in a row. First, we lost Russia because Russia started blackmailing Europe with the gas supplies. And then, of course, we also wanted to get rid of that, those deliveries. But now we are actually also in the process of losing the US as a reliable provider of fossil fuels. Because the current administration of US is clearly showing us that it's not willing to hold old contracts, and it's very much willing to use threats, also including energy-related threats, to get to its goals, whatever they are. And therefore, my conclusion from this situation is actually that Europe is doing a geostrategic mistake by cutting its own oil and gas production, because in this situation where all the providers or many of the providers are not so friendly anymore, we should actually be increasing our own oil and gas production instead of cutting it. This shouldn't mean that we should end our energy transition policies, because those are still helping Europe a lot, but to try to stop our own production before stopping imports of fossil fuels is not a very safe policy in this situation. And I think that's something which we are not awake with this yet, I would say.
Yes. Okay. So there is a, if you go back 15 years, there was a kind of an overall trend for globalization where any sort of supplier anywhere in the world could be matched with any demand anywhere in the world. And that was kind of how things were going to work. And now you're saying that actually some of the largest suppliers are no longer as reliable as we thought, for various reasons. And so we'll still continue with the decarbonization trend, but there is a security element that will be looked at for homegrown extraction of oil and gas for the energy system of Europe, as well as Norway, UK, etc.
Yeah, I would really see it that way. That, well, as I think everyone agrees now, that the Norwegian production has been crucially important for Europe as a whole, like in this latest couple of years. But also anywhere else we can develop some production, it's still worthwhile, because it's not feasible that we would be totally out of oil and gas in the next 10, 15 years. We cannot be that fast, that we know already.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's certainly a contrarian view, and it's also kind of a sober note. And what I think has been a really interesting episode, just to cover all of those regions, all of the dynamics within those regions, and also give the UK that kind of glimpse into the future of what might be with our sort of pricing structures. And also, above all else, to get a view on how battery storage can be impactful in the Nordic. So Riku, a massive thank you for coming on, and for all of our listeners. And yeah, if you have any extra comments around what myself and Riku have run through today, please do let us know in the comments below.